Good to see everyone this morning, and it's good to have visitors with us this morning, some for the first time, and we do appreciate your presence. I would want you to know that we're simply a group of Christians that want to study God's Word in simplicity and in truth, and we want to speak where the Bible speaks and remain silent where the Bible is silent. It's rather a simple goal for each and every one of us as Christ leads us through His Word. So we appreciate your presence this morning. We have, over the last few months, been looking at the Sermon on the Mount, sometimes in a couple of weeks in a row, and sometimes just once or twice. And this is the second, as we've continued the series, picked it up again. So if you'll open your Bibles over to Matthew, the fifth chapter, and those who are familiar with the Sermon on the Mount will immediately recognize that we're not exactly running through the sermon, but we're taking our time and striving to get as much from the Word as possible. We're going to read verse 20, and then we're going to skip down to verse 27. I'll be reading from the New King James, and by the way, later, verses will be on the screen behind me, and they will be in the New King James as well. Verse 20 says in chapter 5, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means inherit the kingdom of God." And then he goes on in verse 27 to say, "You have heard that it has been said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than that your whole body be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than that your whole body be cast into hell." We are looking now at the idea of the righteousness that's going to be found in the new kingdom, the kingdom that's being established by Jesus Christ after His death. He had compared, as we looked in verse 20, He had compared and said, our righteousness needs to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And so we are talking about that kingdom righteousness that is before us and all that is involved. We also, last week, began looking at six illustrations that Christ uses in making the point about our righteousness exceeding the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Last week, we talked about murder. And while indeed the Jews, even the scribes and Pharisees, were establishing and believing in that command to not murder, they were lacking in their understanding of the depth of what was involved. They were glossing over the fact that anger can lead one to that point of murder. And so what Jesus is doing at this time is taking the law, and He is not, as we've sometimes thought, He is not altering, but rather He is reminding them of the depth of what those commands meant. And in doing so, at the close, they will be able to say that He spoke as one having authority. Not because He was changing the law of Moses, but rather He was showing them the depth of that law and the intent then, and the understanding for us as well today. And it's all around this idea of the righteousness found within the kingdom. So the one we're going to look at next is the next within the text, and that is the question of adultery. Now, as we examine this matter of adultery, again, it's the next command after the command that thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not kill, as it were. In verse 14, He says, "You shall not commit adultery." Very clearly they understood that they weren't to commit adultery. In fact, under the old law, that happened to be a capital punishment. One was to be put to death if they were caught in the act of adultery, both the man and the woman. Just as a very quick aside, remember when the woman was brought to Jesus and they didn't stone her to death, though she'd been caught in the very act? And he said, "Neither do I condemn you." Jesus was not glossing over the matter of adultery. He was not glossing over Leviticus, the 20th chapter, verse 10. What was necessary was that both be brought to trial, if you will, both having had witnesses, and therefore the justice of it was carried out. What these people were doing in that mob scene with Jesus was not a fulfillment of what was required for that death penalty, and therefore Jesus took the appropriate action he did. And that's just an aside to the lesson this morning. We find that this matter of adultery certainly carries over into the New Testament. There in Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and verse 4, the Hebrew writer says, "Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers, God will judge." So clearly, God has promised to bring judgment upon those who would commit adultery. And there's good reason that God saw this as such a significant sin. And I know that we want to kind of stay away from that idea of significant sins and minor sins. But I think we all, in fact, I've heard members of the congregation here rightly make mention of the fact that there are just some sins with greater consequences. And therefore, they hold a greater importance to us. That's not to suggest that the lesser things are not just as much as appalling to God. But this matter of adultery, we need to understand that it destroys families. It destroys marriages. It destroys friendships. It contributes to the destruction of many lives, including the lives of the children. So it's not something that is good for the one who commits the adultery. It's not good for the spouse of that one. It's not good for the children of that one. It's not good for the friends of that one. It's not good for society. Interestingly enough, one of the most recent surveys that was taken, and this was an online survey, and I believe it was like over 300,000 participants, over 90% said that they believed that adultery was immoral. And I was impressed at that. Of course, they also went on to say that some 60% acknowledged having committed adultery. Both men and women, men to a larger extent than women. But I want to say something else about this matter of adultery before we get into the text. Oftentimes we think that the idea of adultery is something that happens with a stranger. Now, once a person has become unfaithful, there's a statistic that said that many of them commit adultery while on business trips. But this is what's more important to our consideration, and the warning is what I'm giving here, is that most adultery in these latest surveys have suggested that it comes between co-workers. That's something that has increased since World War II because there are more men and women working together in close space for long periods of time. Sometimes their awaking time is more, they are together more in the waking time than they are with their spouse at home. Because with their spouse at home, it might simply be for an hour, and then in the evening, it might be for just a couple of hours, where you could be 7 or 8 or even longer hours together with that person of the opposite sex. Now, I'm not suggesting that there's anything sinful about it. I'm just saying to each and every one of us, be aware of it, be attuned to it, and keep your guard up. Because when somebody is sharing their problems in a workspace, it's not uncommon to share other problems that arise. And you can seem like such a wonderful man or such a wonderful woman because you understand in ways that the spouse doesn't understand. The irony is many times when one looks at that person with that glowing notion, they've got a spouse at home thinking that person is not worth about 2 cents anyhow because you ought to see them at home. They've got all their flaws with them. So just be aware of that. And here's another statistic. That statistic, I think, is somewhere around 32 to 36%. You know the others that you're most apt to have an affair with? Your brother-in-law or sister-in-law. And I know the first time I ever read that statistic, I shuddered and said, oh, come on. And that's not to suggest I have ugly sister-in-laws. It's just... And I'll go no further with that because they may listen online. Those beautiful women. But again, that's surprising. Those are the two groups, co-workers. In both cases, they're people we're familiar with. A third that's very high on that list is your spouse's best friend. A woman's best female friend may well be the one who commits adultery with your husband. A man's best male friend may well be the one who commits adultery with your wife. Now this week, guys don't go and punch your buddy in case of what he might be thinking, but just be aware of these problems. And this aside took me further aside than I intended to do, so let's get back to the lesson. Quite simply, what brings this on? How does this begin? Well, I would suggest to you that it begins with emotional affairs that take place within the mind. And we're going to see this as we examine the text in greater detail. And as it has developed within the mind, then it moves over to the flirtation, and that's what the picture there is to represent. The guy is looking around his wife, at least as I'm using this picture, to talk to this other woman. Innocent flirtation at first. Flirtation is one of those funny words that we can use it without any harm at all, but I'm using it in the sense where the intent, this is one of the deeper definitions in the dictionary, the intent is more sinister. And the dictionary didn't use that. But it is to eventually accomplish something. So it starts out innocently, but then it gets into little nuances in the language. It gets into double entendres, etc. And the flirtation just goes heavier and heavier. And then you find yourself getting away from, you think, both spouses, and you're just kind of off by yourself. You think they're not going to know. They're not going to be around. And then ultimately, and I'm using this picture as a euphemism for the adultery, it culminates in the act of the sexual betrayal of your spouse. These are all serious things, and we need to keep these things in our mind and recognize that any place along that progression that I've spelled out here, you can bring it to an end. You can stop it. Most importantly, I think we would want to stop it before it even begins. I think the solution is to make sure that we are committed to our spouses. And if we are a single person, because we can commit adultery with a married person, that we are committed to being pure in the eyes of God to where we are not going to involve ourselves in that which will damage our souls or the souls of others. One of the strangest things to me, and Connie and I counseled many people who have been involved in adulterous relationships, is the fact that in among Christians, they have to have reached a point where they don't care about their soul. And this is the one I really drive home in talking to people, they didn't bother caring about the soul of the person they claim to be the new love of their life. I love you so much that I want to commit an act that will send you to hell. I don't think any adulterer or adulteress has whispered that in the ear of the one they were going to commit the adultery with, but that in fact is what's going on under those conditions. There's always the opportunity to stop. And let me say this in a positive note in relation to the matter of adultery. We've dealt with many individuals that have been involved in adulterous relationships. And I don't think it's because of Connie and I, but because of their hearts. Our experience has been that the overwhelming majority, their marriages have been saved because both wanted to restore that marriage to what God wanted it to be. And to the best of my knowledge, the overwhelming majority are happy in that marriage, having put the adulterous act behind them. Now, as we continue on with this Sermon on the Mount, we're back to the example that we used last Sunday when we compare the idea of the kingdom righteousness and the traditional righteousness. And again, like I said before, it's back to this idea, you heard that it was said. Well, when you heard that it was said isn't good enough. Jesus says, but I say to you. And what does He say to them? Jesus says, I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. The significance here is tying in the words look and lust. Because in the original language, the idea of lust is not in fact a morally positive or negative thing. The way in which it's used determines that deep passion as to whether or not it's morally correct or morally sinful. Here, Jesus is making the point that the idea of the looking is what's going to lead to the lust that is negative. I think it's important for us to take a moment to try to stress and understand what's involved in this idea of understanding not just the letter of the law, but what Jesus is teaching with regard to the act. One is not guilty for simply looking at another woman, or a woman looking at another man. Those of us who are extremely handsome, women can't help but look at us, right? But in a serious point, it's what that woman does in her mind, or what that man does in his mind, when looking at that attractive man or that attractive woman. That's the point that Jesus is making. Therein lies the problem for many of them. Therein brings the lust from the morally neutral to the morally condemning. That is immoral, in fact. To lust is the idea of having that strong desire, and in this case, it's negative. I want to read a quote from one commentary, just flat out. Well, it's in my notes here. Yes, it's the biblical expository of commentary on the New Testament. I want to give appropriate credit. Quote, Jesus is not saying that lustful desires are identical to lustful deeds, and therefore a person might just as well go ahead and commit adultery. Jesus doesn't want you to go away thinking, well, if I'm going to lust after her, I might as well commit the act. He's telling of the danger and the sinfulness of both. But the quote goes on to say, and this is the point I really wanted to emphasize, the desire and the deed are not identical, but spiritually speaking, they are equivalent. So that if I look at that woman to the point of lust, The moral equivalent is condemnation by God as if I had committed the adultery. I think what he's doing is showing us the seriousness of this matter. He goes on to say in the comments that I wanted to share with you, the look that Jesus mentions is not a casual glance, but a constant stare with the purpose of lusting. The looking is the idea, if I had the chance, I would do it. Not to simply observe the beauty that God has created in the being, male or female, that one would observe. But it's the idea of looking at her or him and saying, if I could get away with it and my wife would never find out, I'd do that. I'd seduce her. I'd let her seduce me. Or the same for a woman. That's what he's getting at here. Now let me say to you that as we look at a person, if we continually do so and put upon that glancing at them the sexual aspect, ultimately, I think you do cross that point where you enter the lust that Jesus is condemning here. Your look does become the lust. We as men need to be especially careful because we as men are more visually stimulated than the ladies are. Though the ladies, I think, have been made aware of that over the last 30 or 40 years with the women's liberation movement. So that whether it was ever intended or not, many of our young ladies for the last 30 years have come to think, well, hey, I've got to be like a man. I've got to look at men in a sexual way the way men look at us. It's not to say that they go to the point of the vulgarities of construction men, and I was a construction man as a plumber one time, so I'm not smearing them all, but the catcalls. I'm not saying that women give out catcalls. If you do, stop it. I think Jesus' interpretation of the law, of what was being said in the law, is certainly in harmony with the will of God and is in harmony with the commandment to not commit adultery. How does he answer this? He answers this with two vivid metaphors. And metaphors are simply these figures of speech that are used to illustrate a point to be made. He talks first of all about the idea of self-mutilation of the eye in verse 29. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. It's better that you go to judgment with one eye than to have both eyes and go to the eternal damnation. That's a rather deliberate and get your attention point. The other that he uses is the idea of the self-mutilation of the hand. If your hand offends you, cut it off. Better to go to the judgment just one-handed. What we have here, and the young people that were in the teen and young adult class when I taught it last quarter, we all got to know very well the term hyperbole. These are two hyperboles. They're gross exaggerations to make a point. The atheist, the agnostic, the skeptic that wants to have us dismiss the Bible because Jesus says, oh, pluck your eye out, engage in self-mutilation, they're being ignorant of literary technique that they know to be true and it's valid and it's not saying the literal that Jesus is using in the metaphor. Jesus does it later in his ministry, there in Matthew 18, verses 7 through 9. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame and maimed, rather than having two hands and two feet, be cast into the everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one hand, with one eye, rather than having two eyes, to be cast into hellfire. The point is, don't do things that will cause you to stumble. Don't do things that will cause others to stumble. Be aware of that. Stay away from it. And that's what we're to do as we strive to understand these things. The meaning that Jesus is putting forth with these two illustrations is quite simply, get rid of any perversion or exaggeration of the natural lust, the natural passions that God has given us. You've heard me use this a dozen times. For every natural passion I have, God gives me a way to satisfy it. For every natural passion I have, Satan gives me a way to satisfy it. Now, it's my responsibility to make the right choice and how I'm going to satisfy it. So what do we learn from this? Well, we learn that our responsibility is to look to eternity. Whatever pleasure we might get from an illicit relationship, however long it lasts, if it's a one-night stand or if it continues on and on until we get caught, because most relationships continue to the point where ultimately they want to be caught or they just flat out acknowledge it. When you do that, you're not looking to eternity. And that was my point earlier. No man would ever whisper to a woman he was about to commit adultery with, "Hey, let's go to hell together. Come on, baby." No. We need to look to eternity. I'll tell you what. I pray to God that this attitude that I have right now is one that I'll always have, that I've always had, and it will continue. I'm not boastful to say it will always continue, but I pray that it will. I love my God and my soul too much to find illicit ways to fulfill lust. I love my wife too much to hurt her and damage the relationship that God has us bound in. And I believe that's probably, I don't stand here sanctimoniously to you, I would hope that's the heart of every man here and the heart of every woman here as well. Look to eternity. Nothing should stand between us and heaven. In our eyes, our spouse should be the best looking person we know. Are there women more beautiful than my wife? Why have I even said this out loud? I don't know. Spontaneous isn't always wise. My water is leaking here. I need to change subjects. Yes, there are. She's shaking her head, yes. But for my eyes and the purposes God has joined us together, nobody is. Nobody is. And I think the same is true of the heart and eyes and mind of every man here this morning. And the same would be true for you wives regarding your handsome, macho, masculine, virile husband that you're married to. Did you write that down, Connie? No, but she knows it and believes it and tells me. And you don't want to hear any more of that. Here's the last point. Don't coddle sin. Don't pamper sin. Don't play with it. Sin is to the soul what cancer is to the body. And a number of people have had to fight that cancer in their bodies and know the seriousness of it. And therefore, they understand better than the rest of us that have not battled that, the seriousness to our souls of this sin and others as well. Whatever might put you in a position to commit adultery or other sins, cut yourself off from it. If you're in a position where you're working with somebody that either they or you or both have begun to develop emotional, sexual attitudes toward, you need to find another job. Or you need to get that person another job. Or you need to ask to work in another department. If you happen to be in a position of authority, you might even, in fact, I heard of a dentist who one time found himself attracted to his assistant. And he simply went in one day with his wife to the assistant and said, "I need to let you go. This just isn't working for me. It's not you. I will give you the highest recommendation and help you find another job as a dental assistant." That's what you need to do. That's what you need to do. Cut yourself off. Don't coddle sin. We've got some passages we'll close with. Philippians, the 4th chapter, verse 8. "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." Remember the illustration earlier when I had the outline of the head of a person and the way it starts in the mind? Rather than meditate upon that woman's beauty, the great personality she projects that makes you drawn to her, meditate on the things that are pure and wholesome, etc. 1 Corinthians, we always think about it for our young people, but it's applicable to you and I. "Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits." And if somebody begins to act in a seductive way to you, that is evil company. Get away from it. Get away from it. 1 Corinthians tells us in the 6th chapter, verse 18, "Flee sexual immorality, every sin that man does outside the body. But he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body." That's what we need to be willing to do, that we might save our souls, save our families, save our marriages, be right in the eyes of God. The Lord willing, before I go to Vietnam a few weeks from now, because I won't be here this coming next Sunday, but the following Sunday, we may in fact go to the next of these illustrations. But for this morning, I hope the thoughts were beneficial to you and right in the eyes of God. We're going to close by remembering what Paul told the Ephesians, that we are saved by grace and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God. So we are saved by grace means that Christ's death on the cross lays out the opportunity for our salvation. Now we have a responsibility, and that responsibility is to know we're walking in darkness and turn away from that darkness and come to the light of Jesus Christ. If you've not yet done that,